Good evening and welcome to the second episode of this Football Weekly Podcast. I'm your host, Reggie. As always, we can be reached at the website, www.footballweekly.com. That's FUTBOLWEEKLY.com. You can go there and subscribe to the podcast. You can leave comments. You can hit me up on Twitter at Reginald Neal with any show topics, comments on previous shows, and things that you guys would like to hear. Edson's not with me this week. We're not going to go as long as we did last week either. So try to keep it a tight, nice 40-45 minute podcast just to bring you the football news around from around the world. Structure of this show, we'll give you a little bit of news tidbits. We'll talk about some things that are happening in world football. And as always, we'll end off talking about a little bit of us. So sit back, relax, take in the Football Weekly. We'll be back right after this. In this segment, we're going to talk news, world football news. Unfortunately, I have to start off with a sad note. A player in the Algerian domestic league was killed in a game. I'm not even going to say he died in a game. He was killed in a game. One of the fans in the stands threw a rock, hit the kid in the head, and later on that night, he died from his injuries. I don't know if FIFA was going to step in and do something about this, but very sad case. His name was Albert Ibossé. He was a 24-year-old Cameroonian. He was playing for an Algerian side. I can't remember the name of the team. He was only 24 years old, and he was coming off the field. He scored a goal that game. He was coming off the field, and a fan threw a rock from the stands, hit him in the head. He went down, and later on, he died from his injuries. This object throwing from the fans is becoming way too prevalent in the soccer game. Just even I think 2 weeks ago, in a Champions League game, Arsene Wenger, the manager of Arsenal, was targeted with a bottle from the stands. Bottle came down and crashed right next to him. And we all know the stories about Ronaldo being hit with a lighter, and even Theo Walcott. They were throwing coins. Tottenham fans were throwing coins at him. I don't know what to do to stop it. I mean, you can't stop people from bringing things in their pockets, such as coins or lighters and things like that. I mean, you can't really ban all that stuff. So, is everything a projectile? I know when you go to TFC games, they make you take off the tops of your water bottles so you can't throw the caps, but the caps are so flimsy that they're not going to do any harm, and they're not even going to make it to the field. So I know what they're trying to do, but for that instance, it's really nothing could happen if you threw a water bottle cap on the field. Rocks, lighters, coins, different story. All hard, all metal, you know, stones, things like that. And then look what happened. This kid died, and it's a sad case. And I hope FIFA comes down hard on this league and they actually find the person who threw the rock and press criminal charges against him, because you go to a soccer game, the players go to the soccer game to feel safe, and and they want to be safe on the field, and everyone's so worried about hooliganism, but it's starting to take a turn for the worse with this object throwing on the field. Some of the things that we have to look at to stamp that out. Another sad note, but not as sad as somebody dying on the field, or being killed on the field, I should say. For those of you that have watched the Premier League and have paid a little bit of attention to Arsenal, we had a goalie named Manuel Almunia, and unfortunately, this past week he had to retire from competitive football. He was doing a medical at a new team. this past week, and during that medical, they found his, he had a heart condition where the heart walls thicken and cause sudden cardiac arrest. I forget the technical medical name for the condition, but he was told he can't play football anymore, so he was forced to retire. Anytime a player is forced to retire, not on their own terms, is sad in my eyes. I think you should leave the game when you're ready to leave, when it's your time. Whether it be you're too old or you just don't have the love for the game anymore, but you should be able to leave the game on your own terms. And when a doctor or someone tells you that you can't play the sport or the game or do the thing that you love, it's going to be a sad day. So I wish Manuel Almunia all the best in his future endeavors, whether he becomes a goalie coach for one of the teams or he becomes a full-fledged manager. Wish him the best. There was many nights, many days, many games I cursed him, like many other Arsenal fans did as well. But you still don't want to wish that upon anybody, and my heart goes out to him. So good luck to him and all his future endeavors, and I hope we see him again in some capacity within football. Moving on to a little lighter note, actually. Last week, Champions League qualifiers continued. It was the second stage of the playoffs. So it was pretty much crunch day. I know my heart was in my mouth many times on Wednesday afternoon, listening to the Arsenal game at work. So, but on a lighter note, there was a game in, I believe it was Romania. And it was between a team called Lugarets, I believe, and Steaua Bucharest. And obviously, if you know anything about Champions League, these qualifiers are for to get into the Champions League, and the Champions League is a mega, mega money tournament. And we'll get into that a little bit later today, too. But this is an unknown team. I don't even know where they're from. They're an unknown team. Steaua Bucharest is one of the main teams in Romania. 1 and 2 every year. I think it's Dinamo Bucharest. I forget the other team they play against. But these guys are. It was a David and Goliath matchup. Okay. I think Steaua was up from the previous game, so there was 1-0 going into the second leg. And I don't even know how to pronounce their name. That's how unknown they are. But I think it's called Lugarets. They were down, and they scored in injury time. So 90-plus they scored and sent it into overtime. Okay, so they're in overtime. They're playing. Both teams made all three of their substitutions. So they couldn't make any more subs. Steaua Bucharest player goes in on a semi-breakaway. Goalie takes him down. Goalie gets a red card. Okay. So now what do? You can't bring anybody. You can't bring the backup goalie on because you've used all your substitutions. So they have to put an outfield player in the net. So they put their center back in the net. I should have written his name down. I didn't even write his name down. But they put the center back in the net. First thing he has to do is save a free kick on the edge of the... deal with a free kick on the edge of the 18-yard box, which it didn't go on net, so it was fine. But they played the whole overtime, and nobody scored, so it had to go into penalty shots. So now it's like, well, Steaua Bucharest, man, they got all their players. They're a top team in the Romanian league. So I mean, and it's not even a real goalie in the net. So I mean, everyone's just, you know, whatever. This is just a formality. Let's do this. So Ludogorets players it was the goalie, the player who came up, he scored his first penalty shot, and Steaua came and they scored, and Ludogorets came up and they scored, and Steaua scored again, and Ludogorets scored, and now Steaua's up. Steaua Bucharest player is up. And this guy actually saved the penalty shot. He saved the penalty shot, so now they're down. The Ludogorets player comes up. P shoots, Steaua's goalie saves it. So it's still tied. Okay. So now it's getting interesting. I was watching it, and I was just like, I was thinking in my head, it's just a formality. It's a player in the net. Just shoot it. Like, he's not going to get to anything. And this guy was actually diving around like he was a goalie, and he actually saved one. So it went back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Long story short, it went back and forth. After the first five players had taken their shots, it goes into sudden death. So if I score and you don't, game's over, and vice versa. So back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth again. And the Ludogorets goalie, the player, saved another penalty shot. And that was it, game done. Because the Ludogorets player had scored previous, and he saved it. So they had a player in the net save two penalty shots in extra time, and, well, make saves in extra time, and made two saves in the penalty shootout, and now they're off to the Champions League. So that was a, if anybody was out there watching that, you know what I'm talking about, and it's just, I've never seen anything like it in football, and kudos to him. He played amazing. He was diving around like a real goalie out there. It was funny to watch, but now they're off to the Champions League and the big money, so kudos to them. In the intro, I played the Champions League. The Champions League theme was the intro for this show. Arsenal back in it again for the 17th season in a row. They're back in the Champions League. In my opinion, they're lucky, but we'll get into that a little bit later. But I wanted to break down Champions League money, because I have a friend of mine who's just getting in. I'm slowly trying to get him into football, and he doesn't understand the lore, and why is it so, why do you have to finish in the top three or the top four? Like, who cares? And it's just like, well, Champions League, if you finish in the top four in England, you get into the Champions League, and top three in Spain, and top two in Italy, top two in Scotland, you get into the Champions League. Well, who cares about Champions League? What is that? And I told him what it was, and he was just like, what? So I'm just going to break down the prize money that you get for making the Champions League, and it's incredible. I just found this out about 2 weeks ago, how much money these guys make from making the Champions League, and all the money stipulations there are with winning games and drawing games and things, and within group stages and stuff like that. So I'm going to break it down a little bit for you and tell you how much exactly they win, and I don't know if you'll be surprised by it, but I was. Last year's winner, Real Madrid, they made 62 million euros from the Champions League, and I saw that and I thought it was a mistake, so I had to go and look and see the breakdown of how much money the teams make from Champions League. So what I found was this: just to make the Champions League, not even making the Champions League, for a group match, you make 1 million euros, okay? Just for winning a group match, 1 million euros. So to put that in the equivalent for Canadians and U.S., I'll do the Canadian equivalent and the U.S. equivalent for some of these as well. So just for winning a group match, one group match, you get 1 million euros, and that's equivalent to about $1.4 million Canadian. If you tie, you get half a million, which is about half a million euros. The first number I gave you is going to be in euros, so I don't got to keep saying euros, but it's half a million. And that's about $715,000 Canadian for a tie. Okay? So imagine if you win, I don't know, if you're a team like Ludogorets, for example. Not a very big team, not a very popular team. Probably their whole team's salary is probably about $500,000, and they're getting a million euros just to win a game. So you know what kind of big money that is for them. For Real Madrid and teams like Bayern Munich and stuff like that, it's probably just bonus money for them. But for teams like the lower teams in the league, like and the lower teams in the tournament, for the teams that come out of maybe cash-strapped Italy or teams in Romania and all the smaller European champions. So it's big money for them, okay? If you get to the playoffs and you win a game, it's 2.1 million euros, which is equivalent to $3 million Canadian. If you reach the round of 16, it's 3.5 million euros. If you make the quarterfinals, it's about 4 million euros. The losing team makes if you make it to the finals and you lose, you make about 6.5 million euros, which is about $9 million Canadian. And the winning team gets about, they get 10.5 million dollars euro, which is about $15 million Canadian. So Real Madrid won the Champions League last year, and they made 62 million euros, which is about $88 million Canadian, just for that tournament. So now you see why teams are breaking their necks to buy players to get them into the Champions League, and what this Champions League means so much, because it's pretty much they're just handing out money for you just to do well in it. And I mean, if you get a good squad and you're like Barcelona or even Bayern Munich, and you don't lose a game within the group stage, you're pulling in a hefty sum of money into your club, whether you can pay off debt, you can buy new players in January, you can do whatever. That's why teams kind of wait until, well, I know Arsenal does, for example, they wait until they've qualified for Champions League before they start spending, because we need to know if we're going to have this money coming in. If we win 6 or 7 games within the group stage, and maybe make it to the quarterfinals and win a game, then I know we're going to have X amount of money. We're going to have, for instance, we're going to have, I don't know, $10 million, so I can put it towards this, I can put it towards that player, and this, that, and the third. So that's how they budget their money. And it's big money, and it's big business, and it's one of the best tournaments in the world. I love it. That's my number one tournament, Champions League. It's Champions League, then World Cup, and then Euros. So that's how big the Champions League is. But like I said earlier, Arsenal made it again for the 17th year in a row. And like I said earlier, I feel they were lucky, but that's for later debate. Moving on, in this segment, we're going to talk about world football topics. What I want to get into right now anyway is Man United. We're going to talk about a little bit of Man United. We're going to talk Everton, and some of the other transfers that are going on through this transfer window, which ends on Monday, I believe, Monday at 11 p.m. England time. So lots of things going on, lots of movements. What I'm seeing most this transfer window, there are a lot of loans. It's previous transfer windows were more purchasing of players, buying players. In this transfer window, I'm seeing more loans, and I don't know why that is. There might be a stipulation in the contract, actually, or in the loan agreement, that they have the ability to buy the player after the loan is completed, the year-long loan is completed. But just curious to find out and talk to other people about why they think it's more loans this transfer window. And it's not just younger players as well. It's older players. I believe Torres was sent on loan to AC Milan from Chelsea. So it's not just the young kids that are going out to get experience. It's older veterans as well that are being loaned out. And I'd be curious to find out why it's more loans than actual purchases. But let's get into Man U right now. And believe me, as an Arsenal fan, it's great to see Man U struggling. It's great that they have no wins in their last 4 games, I believe. It's great to see them down the table. They went out and bought Angel Di Maria, former Real Madrid winger. In my personal opinion, I don't believe that's the smartest move to make for Man United. They have problem areas all over the field. Well, all over the field, but their main problem is defense. They don't have that steady center back, that go-to center back that they've had for years, whether it be Rio Ferdinand or Nemanja Vidic. They don't have that guy that's back there, like a Vincent Kompany that's intimidating, that's gonna, you know, make you think twice about running at him. And Louis van Gaal wanted to change the system that they were running to, a three defensive man system, which in the Premier League, I don't think it might work in Holland when there's only, or not Holland, sorry, Germany, where there's only two or three good teams and you can get away with playing with three defensemen, or even in Italy or Spain when there's only two or three good teams. But in England, to have three defenders is suicide to me. Anyway, I've never coached in a high division, and Louis van Gaal has a massive resume compared to me, soccer knowledge wise. But for me, watching this league and as closely as I do, the three defensive system, it's never going to work. It's never going to work in the Premier League with the players you have. You have to have three top-notch defensemen that are world-class, and Man United doesn't have it, and they're still trying to force that system in. And that's probably the main reason I see them losing a lot of games. They have to change their formation. Sir Alex Ferguson had them playing, I believe they had them playing, well, he had them playing mainly a 4-4-2, staple formation, with Rooney just playing in behind whichever striker it was, whether it be Chicharito or Van Persie. It just playing a little bit back of the main striker and a little bit in front of the attacking midfielder. So that suited them well for years and years and years. But to come in and change the whole formation, and you're talking about putting kids back there like Phil Jones and this kid Tyler Blackett, and I forget who even's on the other side, whether it be Luke Shaw or I don't even remember, or Chris Smalling or whoever. These kids have never played a three defenseman system. They've always come up with a 4-4-2. So to throw them into that formation at this stage of their careers was a mistake. I believe was a mistake, and if he doesn't change it, it's going to be problems. If I was Man United at the time, I would have better spent that money, that $65 million that they spent to get Angel Di Maria, and I would have bought maybe two or three defensive minded defensemen and changed the formation. I was telling someone the other day, it's to buy a midfielder for that amount of money when you have other problems to address is crazy. It's like you're bringing in another star in a position or an area of the field that you don't need, and you're paying him whatever his salary is. I don't even know what it is, but the transfer fee alone is just, unless you have bags and bags of money like Man City do, you can just throw out $60 million for a player. If you can do that, good for you, but I don't think Man United has it like that, but they've done it. So I can't see them signing anybody else now permanently. Spending that money, they're close to about $100 million they've spent already in this window, and for me, that $65 million would be better suited buying a defensive midfielder to protect the back three if you're going to play three, or someone to fill in for that three. Because even the main defenseman that they bought in the summer before the World Cup, Luke Shaw, has been hurt and he hasn't played yet. But you know what? I don't think him coming in will make any type of difference. So, like I said earlier, love to see Man United losing, but I mean, just from an outsider looking in, I feel that money would have been better spent buying what you need rather than a big name winger. This past week as well, Samuel Eto'o left Chelsea, went to Everton. Mixed feelings about that transfer. I don't think it's gonna take Everton over the top. It's just another striker that they have. They bought Romelu Lukaku this past off season for $28 million, so that would be the main striker. But Eto'o's winding down his career. He's coming to the tail end, so he might be the guy that actually gives Lukaku a rest during maybe FA Cup or Capital. What do they call it now? Is it Capital One Cup or the old Carling Cup games? I think you're going to run with Lukaku through the middle for the majority of the Premier League games. But if anything happens, if you should go down for injury or need a rest, Eto might be a serviceable backup. But can't see that really making a difference in where they finish. I still say they finish out of the top five. But, I mean, I'm not a fortune teller, so they could win the league. But who knows, right? So, but I feel, from what I've seen in the first couple of games, Samuel Eto'o shouldn't make that much of a difference that they finish anywhere higher than they than predicted. Staying with Chelsea and players leaving Chelsea, it's rumored that Fernando Torres would be leaving Chelsea to go to AC Milan in Italy. I really believe that this move would be great for Torres' career. The Italian league isn't as rigorous as the Premier League. For strikers, there won't be that much competition up there, so he should play a lot since they've sold Balotelli to Liverpool. So he should get a lot of games down there. And I think he'll revive his career and he'll go back to the Atletico and even the Liverpool type striker that he was. I think in Chelsea, when he was running with Chelsea, there was too much competition, and it's tough to keep your confidence and consistency up when you don't know if you're going to play the next game, or you play good one game and then you don't play at all the next game, and then you don't play for the next 3 weeks, and then they call you in, and you know what I mean. So he'll be the probably the go-to striker at AC. So look for Fernando Torres to bounce back to the old Torres that we know and feared as an Arsenal fan. When we played Liverpool, it was he almost had the Suarez factor. You know he's going to score. It's just how many is he going to put by us today. So good luck to Torres. I think it was a good move. And once again, like we were talking about earlier, it's a loan. It's a two-year loan deal with, I believe, a contract after to buy, or an opportunity to buy if they feel like if they feel like he's working out in AC Milan. So, like I said, good luck to him. Should be interesting to see how he reacts to the transfer and all the playing time that he should be getting anyways. Moving on to Spain. There's not really much I can say about Spanish football. Call me when Real plays Barcelona, pretty much. Or Atletico plays Barcelona, or Atletico plays Real Madrid. It's pretty much the only teams that, the only three teams that you need to know about in that league. And when the El Clasico comes along, I'll watch it. Other than that, don't care. I mean, I'll watch Suarez, and when he comes back, his first couple of games, to see how he gels with Messi and Neymar and Xavi and Iniesta and those guys, and see just the domination that I feel they're going to have in Spanish football, even with James Rodriguez and Toni Kroos going to Real Madrid, them holding on to Cadera, them re-signing Benzema, and still having Ronaldo there. But I still think, I think with the addition of Suarez, that Barcelona's going to walk all over the La Liga. But you don't win the games on paper, you got to play the game. So, well, like I said, Italy, wake me up when the Milan derby is. Same with Spain, when El Clasico comes around, let me know, I'll watch it. But other than that, we'll definitely talk about those leagues and things that are going on in those leagues, but I can't see anything but a Atletico Barcelona or Real Madrid in whatever order, but those being the top three teams coming out of that league. So now we're going to get into talking about the Champions League. And the draw was held this past Thursday. So all the groups are set for, I think it starts on September 16th or September 17th. Like I said, all the groups are set. The qualifiers were all through the last 2 weeks. So Just want to run down a little bit some of the teams that are in the groups. We won't talk about all the groups, obviously. Take way too long, but there's a couple of groups that stand out. We'll talk a little bit about the groups that the English teams are in and the major teams in world football are in. And starting with Group A, it's Atletico, Juventus, Olympiakos, and Malmo from Sweden. I don't know if we should do predictions. Well, I'll predict the top two teams that are, I think, that are going to come out of that, out of their respective groups. In Group A, I believe Juventus and Atletico should come out. Even though Atletico lost their main striker to Chelsea this past transfer season, this past transfer window, I still think that they have enough quality to pose problems to Olympiakos and Malmo, for sure. Malmo would be the whipping boy of the group, I believe. Olympiakos will give some teams some tough games, but I still think Juventus and Atletico should come out of that group. And Group B, you have Real Madrid, the reigning champions, Basel, Liverpool, and Ludogorets. We spoke about Ludogorets earlier on in the podcast, in the news portion of the podcast. So out of this group, I believe Real Madrid and Liverpool should come out. I think Balotelli will relish playing in for an English team in the Champions League. They say there's nothing better than a European night at Anfield. I tend to disagree. I personally feel they should burn Anfield to the ground, but that's just me. So yeah, out of that group, I believe Real Madrid, too much quality there for the likes of Basel and Ludogorets. I just by the process of elimination, those Basel and Ludogorets shouldn't be any problems for Liverpool and Real Madrid. So I think Real Madrid and Liverpool come out of that group. Group C, you have Benfica from Portugal, Zenit from Russia, Leverkusen from Germany, and Monaco from France. It's an interesting group. Zenit will pose problems for most of the teams in that group, actually. From what I've seen from Benfica this past off-season and preseason, I don't think there'll be any match for even Leverkusen or Monaco. So I believe they'll probably finish last in the group. For me, it's a toss-up between the rest of the three teams in the group. Leverkusen is a solid team from Germany. Monaco, even though we don't know where Falcao is going to be, whether he's going to be sold or loaned out or what. If Monaco keeps Falcao, I actually think it's Monaco and Leverkusen that come out. If they don't, I can see Zenit getting a result in Russia at their home field against any one of those teams. So, depending on what happens with Falcao is what I think is going to happen in Group C. If he leaves, it's Leverkusen and Zenit, I believe. If he stays, I have Leverkusen and Monaco coming out of that group. Group D, Arsenal, Dortmund from Germany, Galatasaray from Turkey, and Anderlecht from Belgium. Tough group. Being an Arsenal fan, you know, I'm going to pick Arsenal as one of the teams that comes out. And I believe Dortmund should be the other team that comes out. But we can't take Galatasaray too lightly either. They had Drogba. I think Wesley Schneider's still there too. So I know Drogba left to go to Chelsea. He was a pain last season in the Champions League. But I still see Dortmund and Arsenal coming out as usual, as like same as last year. So, Group E, you have Bayern from Germany, Man City, CSKA Moscow, and Roma. Every tournament has a group of death, and I think this is the group of death. CSKA Moscow is probably, being a Russian team, we don't really watch a lot of Russian football. We don't get a lot of Russian football where we are. You'd have to actually be dedicated and actually stream that to watch it in Canada anyway. But I know that they're a solid team. They have a lot of, I don't know why a lot of Brazilians flock there, but they do. Always a solid team in the Russian Super League, I think it's called the Russian Super League. Anderlecht from Belgium. They're going to suffer from the two team league syndrome, where it's Scotland, we're in Spain, and in Italy as well, where there's only two good teams in your league. Okay, you're going to finish, if you're any type of good team, you're going to finish one or two. And that's what's happening. That's what happens with Celtic and Rangers when they enter the Champions League. They finish first in their division or whatever, and they come and play Champions League and get smashed, and they're out in the group stage. That's what I think Anderlecht's. That's what I think Anderlecht's gonna. That's how I feel Anderlecht's gonna come out as well too. They are. For me, Bayern's the lock to come out of the group on top. The second place team, Man City, Roma, Moscow. That's a tough group. That's a tough group. So I'm going to take the easy way out, and I'm going to say Bayern for sure. And it's a toss-up between the next three teams. Each of these teams can cause damage on their home field. So as long as they win games at home, and he can sneak a draw on the road somewhere, it's going to be a toss-up for that group. I can't say for sure. It's not like an easy group to pick. So I see Bayern coming out, but after that, it's a toss-up in the air. So I know I'm on the fence about that, but that's too tough to call. If I had to put money down, I would have to say Man City, because they're tough at home, and Bayern to come out. But I mean, for that group, it could flip around any which way. So, in Group F, we have Barcelona, Paris Saint-Germain, Ajax from the Netherlands, and Apoel from Cyprus. Apoel will be the whipping boy of that group, so we won't talk about that. But Barcelona and Paris Saint-Germain, two teams that spend a lot of money in bringing quality players, that should be a sight to behold. Zlatan Ibrahimovic used to play for Barcelona, so he'll relish coming back to the new camp and hopefully putting some goals past Barcelona's former team. But for that group, I see Paris Saint-Germain and Barcelona coming out of that group. Group G, you have Chelsea, Schalke, Sporting Lisbon from Portugal, and Maribor from, I guess that's what, Slovenia? Slovenia, I guess. Well, I guess Chelsea took over Man U's spot for the easy group. I can't remember Manchester United having a tough group in the first round of the Champions League. They always get the whipping boys. They seem to always get the whipping boys in their group. So I guess Chelsea took over their their spot in Champions League this year. Chelsea should smash all three of these teams. So I have Chelsea and Schalke coming out of this group, Group G. And the last and final group is Group H. We have Porto from Portugal, Shakhtar Donetsk, Atletico from Spain, and Bate from Belarus. Bate would be the whipping boy. I can see Shakhtar Donetsk and Porto coming out of this group. Shakhtar Donetsk always has a tough team to play. They're going to the Ukraine and playing on the road is tough. But I can see Porto getting a result on the road from either Athletic Bilbao. To come out of that group. So those are the groups, the Champions League groups. That should be a great tournament. I like I said earlier, I love the Champions League. I put the Champions League before the World Cup. You know, so I can't wait for Champions League to start. 2:45 Tuesday and Wednesday. Oh wow! So hopefully it'd be a good tournament actually, and we'll see. We'll see some good football This is the reason why you need to have a deep team, especially if you're in Champions League. And everybody makes such a big deal about going out and buying players, and you need depth. And this is why you need depth. Because if you had Champions League games, plus your domestic league, plus your domestic cups, you're talking about 50 to 60 games per season. And players can't play that. Players can't play 50 or 60. You need backups. You got to give these guys a rest. It is a physical and endurance type of sport. Can't play three. Can't play two high level games per week. It's impossible for a whole season and do it for 60 games. So that's why you need depth, and that's why we scream at teams. Well, I scream at Arsenal or Arsene Wenger to go out and get depth. You need depth of position. We ran last year with one striker the whole year, and we were lucky he didn't get injured. But we had one striker. If he was sick, he had to play. I mean, it's tough. It's tough on him. And then when he doesn't perform, everyone, oh, he's shit, he's this, he's that. But it's not really. He's just, you know, you can't put someone through that the mental stress and the physical stress of playing league games that are 100%, 100 miles an hour, and then going and playing Champions League games, which are 100%, 100 miles an hour. Can't do it. Can't do it. And that's why we always say you have to have depth. Whether you have, and you look at teams like Real Madrid, and you look at teams like Barcelona, always buying players, Man City, always buying players, just to have the depth. If this guy's not on, we put someone else on. If this guy needs a rest, we put this guy on. And That's why fans cry for players to come in, not just for the domestic leagues, but for all these other extra tournaments and things like that. So that we'll be talking a lot about Champions League throughout the podcast as it gets started. Like I said, in a couple of weeks we should have the first opening group games, and yeah, should be fun. So moving along. Arsenal. Couple of issues with my squad. Couple of major issues with my squad, actually. And it's been going on for years and years and years, and I don't know why the higher-ups at the team can't see what we all see. Or if they see it and they just don't care. As I just spoke about 2 minutes ago about having depth on your squad. The way the Arsenal team is set up, and the way that Arsene Wenger and the rest of the board, they buy players, baffles me. And I'm going to explain to you why. Defensively, I think this year now finally even last year we were fine defensively. To rotate the middle center backs between Mertesacker, Koscielny, and Vermaelen would have been a dream come true. But for some reason, Vermaelen never played, and it was only Koscielny and Mertesacker. For me, Mertesacker is slower than molasses, and in a one-on-one situation, that's the last guy I would want to have in a one-on-one situation with any forward in the EPL. He's just too slow. He's too slow to turn, and he's tall, and he can win the head balls, the high balls, the balls in the air. But if you got Aguero running at this guy, I'm putting my money on Aguero. So, for me, a better partnership would probably have been Koscielny and Vermaelen, because they're both versatile, they're both quick, they both tackle, and they both have ball sense. But, whatever, they played well, Mertesacker and Koscielny. I guess Koscielny's doing more of the covering for Mertesacker. So you have a quick guy back there. So, but for me, Vermaelen and Koscielny would have been the best. But anyways, whatever. The defense was fine. On the left side, you have Kieran Gibbs, and you got Nacho Monreal, they both, to me, they both stink. They both have to go, in my opinion, but Arsene Wenger has a hard-on for Gibbs. I don't know why. I think he's terrible. And Nacho Monreal is terrible. I don't think he's terrible. Doesn't make the right decisions, doesn't make the right runs. I don't think you can, the way that Arsenal wants to attack down the wings, I don't think you can play him with guys like Ozil and Wilshere. Monreal is just not on the same wavelength or has the same type of soccer sense as these guys to be in the right position, know when to make the run, know when to cross it and maybe fake a cross and then cut in. You know, he doesn't do that. I know when Monreal's running down the wing, he's going to cross it. I know that. whether there's anyone in the box or not, he's going to cross it. And I think they need an upgrade at that position for sure. And on the right side, they brought in Debuchy. They got rid of Sanya and they brought in Debuchy. And they have, they brought in Callum Chambers to play right back as well, but he hasn't played right back this season. Debuchy and Callum Chambers, that side's okay. I'm fine with them. I'm fine with Debuchy. But the frustrating part of the Arsenal setup, to me, is the midfield, okay? You have so many midfielders. You have too many midfielders, in my opinion. And In the areas of the field, just like going back to the Man United, Di Maria issue, you don't need Di Maria. You need defense. Man United, I'm talking about. You don't need Di Maria. You need defensemen. And I believe the same thing about Arsenal. Don't need to get another midfielder. We need a striker. We need a striker. Now, you're going to look at the lineup and you're going to say, well, they got Giroud, they got Sanogo, they got Campbell, they got Podolski, they can put Walcott there. Yeah, sure, okay, yeah, that's fine and dandy. You can do that. But Arsene Wenger doesn't. Arsene Wenger, to me, is the king of playing players out of position. He took a winger from Monaco, from Juventus, actually, named Thierry Henry. He played wing. And he put him as a striker, main striker, middle, in the middle of the field. And well, and the rest is history. You know about Thierry Henry. So now I think he feels he can just take any player and mold them into whatever he needs them to be. Ozil shouldn't be playing on the wing. First. Should be playing just behind the second striker in the middle of the field. A. You want wingers, you put Oxlade-Chamberlain on one side, you put Walcott on the other, and you just burn the wings. Got Debuchy coming up behind one of them, and I guess you got Gibbs coming up the other side of the other side. Teams won't know what to do. Put Jack in a holding role beside, I don't know, Flamini, if you want. So he can provide the tough tackling, get the ball to Jack, and let him distribute and find whoever's on the wing or Ozil to get the ball up to the strikers. You're taking a player like Podolski, who came from Cologne. He was a leading scorer on the team when he came from Cologne, I believe, 3 years ago. And you put him on a wing. He's not a winger. Wingers have to track back and mark and tackle. Ozil's not doing that. Podolski's not doing that. He can't put these guys on the wing. Can't put them on the wing. So what do you do? What do you do up top? What do you do up top when Giroud gets hurt? And this is the problem we have right now. Giroud broke his ankle. He's out for 3 months. Now we're scrambling for a striker. And then Arsene Wenger would sit down and tell you, oh, yeah, well, don't worry about it. We have a striker. Yaya Sanogo. In the preseason, he scored 4 goals against Benfica. Okay, so everyone thought, okay, this guy, now he has it, he's coming out. No, this guy's not good enough. This guy should go out on loan, and you should get serious and buy a real striker. because he's not ready for the Premier League right now. You can learn on the fly. You can put him in and have him learn on the fly, but we're not going to win games with him. We're not going to score goals with him. Unless you want, and this is what I think he Arsene Wenger, his wet dream is that his midfielders score goals. Out of the five midfielders that he have, and you can even add Alexis Sanchez into the mix, out of the five midfielders that he has, three of them are going to have to score 10 goals. In this next 3 to 4 months, they're going to have to score a lot of goals. Because I can't see Yaya Sanogo leading the line and scoring goals. So you're going to put Podolski there? Put Podolski there. Even put Joel Campbell there. I don't feel Alexis Sanchez can lead the line. I think he's more of a secondary striker where he can pick the ball up from a little bit deeper and run at people because he's very tricky and very slithery to get through. I don't think he's going to be the hold-up man or the target man that you want. I think when he picks up the ball at, say, 25 yards out and starts making runs at you, then I think that's going to be problems. So you can't, I don't think you should put Sanchez up top as a lone striker. And if you want to play with a target man, I get it. You want to have Sanogo or Giroud up there. They're like 6'3", 6'4", or whatever, strong, and they can hold the ball. But at least Giroud can pop some goals every now and then. I can't see Sanogo scoring a goal in the Premier League. Can't see it. So if Arsene Wenger wants goals from the midfield, they're going to have to come from the midfield. If he wants goals, they're going to have to come from the midfield. And you got, I guess you, if you want, you can say you got Sanchez there, you got Ozil, Wilshere. You're going to have Walcott back. You have Oxlade-Chamberlain, Arizicki. You put Podolski in the midfield. You put, what else is there? You have Flamini in the midfield. If Diaby ever gets his act together and stops getting hurt, you have him in the midfield. It's just too many midfielders for my liking. You can get rid of maybe two of those, even Arteta, you can get rid of two of those midfielders and get a proper striker that can lead the line. And the formation that we play, he has to play that formation. It's a four, I guess, well, you want to call that a four. It's a 4-5-1. Okay, but there's two holding midfielders and whatnot, so you can say it's a 4-2-3-1 or whatever, but it's a 4-5-1. And you have to play that formation because you got 30 midfielders and you have to find room to play them all. I wish we had that problem at up top. But they play Leicester City this week. It should be a game that they win. It should be a game that they win, but like I said, in this league, you never know. Earlier on, I said that they were lucky to make champ to get that goal in Champions League, and I still feel that. As a seeded team in the Champions League, playing in one of the best leagues in the world, I know Besiktas isn't a slouch team, but we still should have taken care of business on their field. The draw wasn't a bad result, but we still should have taken a result from them. And when they came to the Emirates Stadium to play last week, I believe, I think it should have been a slaughterhouse. I mean, we really only had to watch a couple of players on their team, one of them being Demba Ba. And there was times in the game where they could have scored. So I don't think Arsenal fans or Arsenal management should rest on their laurels right now. For me, I think they still need, like I said, I'm good with the defense, the middle of the defense. If you want to rotate Koscielny, Mertesacker, and Chambers, I'm good with that. No problem with that. If you want to rotate Gibbs and Monreal, I guess. That's the only weakness I see, those two. But Gibbs is hurt anyway. Surprise, surprise. Even got a kid on the bench named Hector Bellerin. Kid showed improved in the Emirates Cup, the preseason tournament that we have. He looked good. He's quick. more offensive type of defenseman played against Benfica, so they really didn't provide any challenge to him defensively down his right side. But I'd like to see him get a couple of games, and I'd like to see Joel Campbell play a lot more too. But like I said, they can't rest on their laurels. They have to go out and they have to get maybe another defensive midfielder, because Arteta's going to be done for a while, and they definitely 100% have to get another striker. And the names that are floating around out there, there's Huntelaar, there's Falcao, there's who else is out there? Well, there's a whole bunch of names out there. There's so many of them that I'm blanking out, but they have to go out and get a main striker. Even if Giroud didn't get hurt, they still had to go out and get a striker. But now it's desperate times now. And the price is probably going to go up because they know that we need to buy a striker. But it'd be very interesting to see what type of cover they can get for that striker position, because they definitely need it. Definitely need it. I know they were looking at bringing in Zigic. For those of you who don't know, this guy's about 6'6", striker, 33-year-old player. I don't think Arsene Wenger is gonna go out and try and get him, but that's a big target man you have there. So his name's been bandied about as well. But this should be a very interesting season. I was actually listening to the commentary for the Champions League game from last week, and the commentator was saying something, and it was like, it's the third game of their season, it's already like a cup final, this Champions League game. And it's true. It's the third game of the season, and my heart's in my mouth watching it, especially when we got a red card and we had to play the last, I guess, 20 minutes down a man. And, you know, and it's like, if they score, if Besiktas had scored, we had scored in the end of the first half, but if Besiktas had scored, we would have to go and actually get another goal, because if they had scored, we were out. So, I mean, I was watching it on my phone at work, so it was very stressful to watch. And but it's the third. It's their third competitive game of the season, and it was already like that. I can imagine what's going to happen when it gets down to Christmas time, or even down to the crunch time at the end of the season, where every point counts. So that's why I love the English Premier League, because every game, you never know, right? You never know. So, that being said, thanks for listening to this episode 2 of the Football Weekly Podcast. Hopefully we'll have Edson back next week. We could bounce some things off him. The end of the transfer window should hit on Monday. So, by the time the next show airs, all the transfers will be completely finished, and hopefully we'll have a lot to talk about. But like I said, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next week. Thank you.
Boys and girls, London calling. Now don't look to us, phony Beatlemania is bitten the dust. London calling, see we ain't got no swing, except for the rain and the crunch of things. The ice age is coming, the sun's zooming in, meltdown expected, the wheat is going in. Engines stop running, but I have no fear, 'cause London is drowning. The imitation zone. Forget it, brother, you can go it alone. London calling to the
the zombies of death. Quit holding out and draw another breath. London calling, and I don't want to shout, but while we were talking, I saw you nodding out. London calling, see, we ain't got no hide, except for that one with the yellowy eyes. The ice age is coming, the sun's zooming in, engines stop running, the wheat is going thick, a nuclear error. But I have no fear, cause London is drowning. It was true. London